Hey, everybody. J.J. Cooper, Jacob Rudner, Peter Flaherty here. A Baseball America College podcast, but it's special. We're doing it on Monday because it's Selection Monday, so why wouldn't we do it on Monday? We have to talk about this. I joined in because I could not join in and enjoy. It's a special day every year at Baseball America. It's more special on the years that we do get. We would love to get 64 of 64, but 63 of 64 predicted picks right is something we will we'll definitely live with each and every year. Great to see you guys. It's here now. We've been talking about it. We've been predicting it for months. Jacob, I'll just start with you. Like, now that it's here, what are your first takeaways of, you know, this, the 2025 Field of 64?
Well, I think it was pretty chalk. And I think that that was kind of all of our reaction when the field came out. We predicted, like you just said, 63 of 64. There weren't a ton of surprises. I don't know that you could really argue that there were any snubs. And that was probably my initial takeaway, was that the committee did a pretty good job. I do think that Xavier and UConn, as we're going to get into later, had real cases to get in. But would I go as far as to classify them as snubs? Like, should they have gotten in over Kentucky? No, I don't necessarily feel very strongly about that. Again, it falls more into the bucket of, like, could you have argued them in? Yeah, you probably could have. But I don't think that there was anything egregious. I think that the hosting line made a lot of sense. Were there some surprises there? Yeah, maybe a little bit. But I think, generally speaking, my biggest takeaway was that this was a really good field. I think that the committee did a good job, and that there are some upsets potentially in this field, which keeps it really exciting, especially in this season that's been pretty volatile.
Peter, kind of the same question for you, but kind of just putting it this way. It does feel like that this is one of the years where, you know, there are years where the selection committee gets done and you're like, I just listened to the explanation they give and I still don't understand why Team X is in over Team Y. I felt like this year, yeah, you came away from it going, even the teams who have a reason to be upset, they can't be as upset as we have years where it's like, no, this was just a travesty of justice.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of feel the same way that Jacob does, and not to speak for you, but I think the same way that you do. Like, we have our own little quibbles and nitpicks, but I don't think at any point during the selection show, certainly I didn't feel this way, where I almost fell back in my chair and was like, whoa, why is this team here? Why is this team not here? Why is this team left out? Like, sure, there are teams that are outside the field that had very compelling cases to be an at-large bid, as we'll get into. And then certainly there are a couple of number two seeds that had equally compelling cases, if not more compelling cases to host. But I thought all in all, the committee did a good job. We had, you know, last night, a little bit of a peek under the hood to our final Field of 64 projection. We had pretty much settled on 62 or 63 of the teams. But the only thing that we really debated for a long time was that 64th team. So I think the committee probably felt the same way. And overall, I thought they did a good job.
By the way, credit to these guys. The amount of 2 a.m., 3 a.m. discussions that have happened this week to try to continually update the projected field every day is kind of legendary. It's impressive. But I kind of taking off of that, like we said, this is not a year where we're going to say, oh, there are multiple inexplicable decisions that happened here. We can understand the logic of all of this, but that doesn't mean that there aren't teams. Might not be a conference that could be a little upset. Going right back to you, Peter, like, if you're the Big East today, that's probably, I would say, you could say UConn, you could say Xavier. I would say more, though, you could say that the conference itself is looking at it going, what happened today?
Yeah, so up until a few days ago, you know, we had thought there was a legitimate chance the Big East would be a three-bid league for the first time since 2011. Conference tournament champion took care of the at-large bid. But we had felt, again, last night that with, you know, the Big East isn't the ACC or the SEC, but this year it's a talented conference. And we felt as if with the body of works that UConn and Xavier had put together, that we would be a little surprised if after all of that, it was going to just be a one bid league. The two clubs had pretty comparable RPIs at 41 and 39 respectively, with UConn and Xavier, along with other favorable metrics. But UConn had a share of the regular season title. They're playing for a conference championship. Xavier is obviously the metric darling between the two of them. And so when the dust had settled, and for it to just end up as, you know, Creighton being the lone team, the lone representative from the conference, I was a little surprised. I don't think disappointing is the right word, but I think if you are like a Big East Nick or, you know, a member of the conference, it's hard to not come away at least a little discouraged.
Jacob, kind of along those lines, it also seems like in some of these cases, you know, it is obviously tougher. They've de-emphasized RPI a little bit, partly because of this. They've tweaked RPI over the years because of this. But it's obviously tougher if you are a cold weather team, just in general, to strength the schedule, all this. That's kind of one of the things that stood out about Xavier is it really was, I other than win more games, you can always win more games. Other than that, I don't know much more what else they could have done to kind of make their case. Because when you look at their schedule and all that, they really did kind of build this case about as well as they could with the number of wins that they had.
There's no doubt about that. And I think that, you know, I had a conversation this morning with Xavier head coach Billy O'Connor right after the selection show ended. And one thing that he told me that I thought was really interesting is, where does this leave the Big East? What do you do moving forward? I mean, if you're in his shoes, like you just mentioned, they played the number four non-con strength of schedule specifically to be able to challenge themselves and have a case to get into the field as an at-large. That was explicitly what Billy said. He thought that Xavier would have a case to get in if they challenged themselves regardless of how the record played out. Obviously, you can't go and get run off the table by every single one of those teams, but this, we're not talking about a Xavier group that completely failed in the quad one, quad two category. Like Peter said, they finished 39th overall in RPI. They had 16 total quad one and quad two wins to 24 losses. I would argue that that's probably about as good as it's going to get for a Xavier in that level of competition, and they still didn't get in. So the question becomes, do you continue to challenge yourself? Because the things like the cold weather are a factor early on, so you're not playing at home a whole bunch. You are playing challenging teams. And in the words of both O'Connor and UConn head coach Jim Penders, you're burning yourself out early. Travel is difficult. They aren't staying in Ritz-Carltons. They're busing to a lot of these places. And so there are a lot of inherent challenges that come with being a Big East team. So if the metrics aren't going to save you when it comes to the at-large conversation at the end of the year, the question for these coaches essentially becomes, should we make our schedules easier and gun for the Big East title in the conference tournament? And the answer this year seems like, yeah, they probably should have. I thought it was really interesting. I was having a conversation, you know, at the end of the season, Xavier plays Penn State. They lose 2 of 3 in that series. I think a lot of people would have argued win that series, maybe sweep it, and they would have had a really good argument to get in. Well, they obviously lost that series. They didn't get into the postseason, but they also threw themselves at Penn State. They threw their best pitchers. They put out their best lineups. They used their best relievers, and they burnt themselves out effectively before the conference tournament began. If they could do it over again, I wonder if they would do the same thing. Would you go and throw your best guys, your regular rotation starters, or do you maybe try and save up arms and energy to get into the Big East tournament and go on and win it, which is at the end of the day, what saved Creighton. So I think the biggest question that comes from this season's selection committee results is really, what do the mid-majors like Xavier, like UConn, what do you do? Do you schedule really challenging and do you play for, you know, having the metrics like Peter talked about and being the metric darling? Or do you kind of lay back a little bit and play a Western Kentucky-like schedule, which was reasonably easy, and figure out how to get your way into the tournament via your conference tournament? So it's kind of an interesting predicament. I don't know that there's a right answer. It does kind of seem like the goalposts move a little bit every season. And to be clear, this is not to say that I think the committee got it wrong necessarily. I just think that there was a really good argument for those Big East teams. And I think it's really fair that they have questions as a result of this.
But Jacob, also kind of like that, the other thing that stood out to me and I think stood out to us is we had Kentucky as being kind of on that bubble. The message of the selection committee is, no, they weren't on the bubble. They weren't even one of the last four in, which means in the committee's view, not only did the SEC have the top four seeds and six of the top seven, but the closest thing to a bubble team that the SEC had for their 13th bid was not on the bubble. Like, that was a slam dunk, easy path in team, which I would say, if you said, what do the mid-majors do? The message of this is, again, this is not, you know, to go all Moneyball on this, it's not a fair game. Like, you know that you're kind of up against a stacked deck, and it's only going to get worse. And there's a little further reminder of this when you see where that.
Sorry. Well, one mid-major coach texted me immediately after the selection show ended, and he basically said the best thing that Kentucky did for its resume is play in the SEC. It's not really anything it did. It's more where it existed. And I think that that's really true. I mean, we're talking about a team that's 13 and 17 at the end of the regular season in conference. They're 8-19 against quad one teams. They have a combined 4 losses in quad 3 and quad 4. Overall record, not terribly impressive at 29-25. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that there are a lot of questions that come from how a Kentucky gets into the field and a team like Xavier isn't even in the last 4. And, you know, for us, just to kind of give, like Peter said, a look behind the curtain here, we left Kentucky out of the field because we just didn't have a lot of conviction that the numbers I just read off would be enough to get in. Because like I said, if you're weighing how exactly this happened, it kind of comes down to the conference that you played in, not what you did in that conference. And so, you know, there is precedent for 13-win SEC teams getting in. It's reasonably rare that they don't. The last team that didn't at 13 conference wins was 2022 South Carolina. And I think that there's an important distinction there. They were ranked 67th in RPI, whereas Kentucky is much, much higher than that. I think at 38 was their final resting spot in the RPI. You know, to me, there is some value in the historical precedent. I do think that the committee was right to include Kentucky because every year, and this was the case over at BA throughout the course of the season, we had been saying SEC teams need to get to 13 if you want to feel safe. Kentucky did do that in the hardest conference to play in baseball. So I'm not going to sit here and argue against Kentucky getting into the field as much as I am just going to say it's interesting to me that the RPI, which was a factor clearly in the seeding, which was a factor clearly in how a lot of other teams got into the field, didn't really seem to hold the same weight for a team like Xavier and for a team like UConn. But again, it's really hard to gripe with, you know, a Kentucky who won 13 games in the toughest conference getting into the field.
And I should clarify, when I say it's an unfair game, I don't mean that there's biases or anything like that. I just mean the fact that we know that resources-wise, we know that with the transfer rules and all that, I mean, we are seeing kind of like when you all have been saying all year, the SEC is the most talented conference. A lot of that is that a lot of things that have happened over the last 5 years are kind of creating the environment for the SEC and to some extent the ACC, who by the way, were the entirety of last year's field in Omaha, to become even more dominant. And, you know, again, it is something where if you're at a mid-major, I do think there's a little bit of scratching your head of, man, you know, this is just getting tougher and tougher. But speaking of the SEC, I think we felt for most of the year pretty comfortable, pretty confident that it was likely that an SEC team was going to be the number one seed. But Peter, I don't think that we thought it was going to be Vanderbilt for most of the year.
No.
What stands out about the Commodores besides the fact, you know, like what has happened here that has them as not just the number one seed, but not even a surprise when it was announced?
Yeah, so I mean, this is a trend that bodes really well for the postseason, but they are playing their best baseball at the perfect time. And they were viewed in a favorable light from, you know, a top 8 national seed perspective for some time now. But they kind of made a real run at the number one overall seed down the stretch and crossed the finish line and rightfully earned that title. They took 2 of 3 at Tennessee, followed up with a sweep of Kentucky, and then they stormed their way through the SEC tournament and won the SEC tournament title, its second SEC tournament title in the last 3 seasons. And when you combine that with the fact that they have the number one overall RPI, the number 2 strength of schedule, 18 quad one wins, which ranks second nationally behind only Ole Miss, and 29 Q1 and Q2 wins overall, it kind of felt like a pretty slam dunk case when all was said and done. At least in our last couple of phone calls with Jacob and I, it was kind of a set it and forget it with Vanderbilt at number one. and it's a really well-rounded team, especially on the pitching staff. You know, for me at least, and we'll get into it a little more as we dissect the field and discuss the upside of certain clubs, but their depth on the mound really stands out. Like, they have four legitimate dudes that they can start and feel really confident in getting a quality start out of, with Cody Bowker, JD Thompson, Austin Nye, and Connor Fennell. And then you throw in a bevy of bullpen weapons. Their pitching staff is going to not only keep it in most, if not every game it plays in June, however many that might be, but it's enough on its own to get it to Omaha and potentially have a dogpile at Charles Schwab Field.
Jacob, the other thing that stands out about that is that you talked about 13-win SEC teams. That was Vanderbilt last year. That was Vanderbilt was barely into the field, 0-2 in their regional, go home. That, and really, there was kind of questions like, okay, is this Vanderbilt team built for the game as it currently exists in college baseball? Here we are a year later. They're the number one national seed. What's happened? What's changed at Vanderbilt to kind of really turn these things around?
You know, I actually think it's interesting because the way that they've cracked this is actually by seemingly regressing when it comes to the qualities that we've come to define good power conference baseball teams by. When we're talking about good SEC baseball right now, I think the two things that define it are power pitching and power hitting. We see a lot of home runs. We see a lot of velocity. I was in Hoover this week. I watched Chase Shores at LSU touch 102 miles per hour multiple times in the same inning. It wasn't like he just reached back and did it once. He was sitting 99 to 101 and grabbed 102, I think, five times in a two-inning outing. So we're talking about the most, you know, statistically and tools-wise ridiculous league out there. Vanderbilt's gone the other way and realized a lot of success from it. They are throwing fastballs among their top five most used pitchers by innings pitched at the lowest average velocity that they have since they won the national title in 2019. And what has come with that is the best control that they've had since 2019. They're throwing more strikes. They're not issuing as many free passes overall. I also would say that they are playing a lot better defense than they have. I was talking to Tim Corbin in Hoover, and he said that this might be the best defensive team he's ever had in 23 seasons at Vanderbilt. And that has allowed them to pitch to contact. It's allowed them to be very confident in the fact that if the ball gets put in play, it can produce outs. And the other thing is, they are literally telling their pitchers, throw the ball in the zone because solo home runs cannot hurt us. And on the flip side, on offense, they aren't hitting home runs. 60 home runs on the season is the fewest that they've had in that stretch since they last won a national
championship. Which was a flaw, which felt like a flaw last year of their team. That was the question last year, is like they didn't have any power.
Correct. And this year, they doubled down, but they've also started running more. And I think that that's a huge point when it comes to the state of college baseball right now, because catchers aren't capable of holding on elite athletes the same way that we've come to expect at the professional level. I think that one thing that gets kind of blurred when people are thinking about, you know, baseball theory, we've seen in recent years the stolen base kind of dry up. And I know in very recent years, it's come back a little bit. But generally speaking, that had been kind of a dying trend. And in college, we've seen a lot of evidence that teams that can run actually produce a lot better. Putting pressure on defenses is valuable. Bunting is a more valuable skill in college baseball than it is in the pros, because the chances that a third baseman is going to go and make a good play are just less good, plainly. Go ahead.
Defenses are not as good. Like, do not think of this as your watch. If you are tuning in on ESPN this weekend and you're normally watching Major League Baseball and then you flip over, oh, I'm going to watch some college baseball, you'll get reminded pretty quickly, these are amateurs.
Right. And I think that for Vanderbilt, taking advantage of that reality was something that they just needed to lean into more. And it didn't necessarily mean hitting more home runs, which, by the way, is also a byproduct of the skill gap that you're talking about right there. Facing worse pitchers does tend to produce more home runs. The other thing that helps a lot, metal bats. But for this Vanderbilt team, the ability to be athletic and to put pressure on defenses and to go station to station has been what's defined them. I watched them beat a very powerful Tennessee lineup, 10-0. They didn't hit a single extra base hit in a run rule win game. 13 singles to score 10 runs in seven innings and grab a win. And all while, by the way, they didn't have a single guy go on the mound in top 96. So it's a very different looking club. I think that it is a unique strategy. But at this point in the season, when you've locked up the number one seed, you've won the SEC tournament, and you have more quad one, quad two wins than any other team in the country, there's a pretty decent amount of evidence that it was a good bet.
So, Pete, the other thing that stands out among the national seeds, another thing I should say, not the only, but another thing that stands out is Oregon State gets the eight, which there was questions with that. What does that mean? How important is that for Oregon State?
I think it's important for them. Obviously, that's a victory for the program in its first year as an independent. It nets a top eight national seed. And the metrics were in a favorable spot. Obviously, they had an RPI of 7 to go along with 20 Q1 and Q2 wins. But not to kind of go off the rails on this question and segue into potentially a future one, but I was more so focused slash surprised on Coastal Carolina or even like a Clemson or Florida State, even an Ole Miss to an extent, not getting that top eight national seed, simply rewarding playing in a conference and a tough one at that, especially when you look at Coastal Carolina. And this applies the same sort of, well, what does this mean for the Big East theme? Applies a little bit to Coastal Carolina with, you know, is it impossible now for a quote unquote mid-major team or a non-power four team to get a top eight national seed? Coastal Carolina this year has won 48 overall games. They have the number eight RPI, Sun Belt double champs. They have the most conference wins in school history. They have 15 Q1 and Q2 wins, and they have a top 15 non-conference strength of schedule. If that's not a top eight resume, then I'm not sure whatever will be for one of these teams that plays in the Sun Belt or again, any non-power four team. So I was not only surprised to see Oregon State get a top eight national seed, but I was even more stunned to see Coastal down at 13. I think it would have been a little easier to stomach if they were 9 or even 10, but all the way down at 13 feels a little bit egregious. That might be a strong word, but that was really surprising. And then I think Ole Miss actually had a really, really strong case as well to have that last top eight national seed. They won 20 SEC games. They have a top five strength of schedule. It's 19 Q1 wins or the most Q1 wins of any team in the country. That's a pretty compelling case as well, especially with how much we saw today the committee values playing in the SEC. We saw it early on with Auburn getting the last top four national seed. You kind of felt right then and there Kentucky was in a good spot to get in, just given how they value the conference. So certainly surprised to see the Beavers as the number eight national seed.
I actually, if I could just add real quick, I'm more than surprised to see the Beavers as a top eight national seed. I actually think that if there's one thing that I would peg as, you know, quote unquote, disappointing about this year's field, and I know I've already said that I don't really have any major gripes, which I don't, but if I had to generate one here, it would be Oregon State getting the number eight overall national seed. I just don't really get it. Like Peter said, for Coastal Carolina, what do you need to do to get in? And yes, I understand that Coastal Carolina is in the Sun Belt. Oregon State's not in a conference. And, you know, I was on the call with J.R. Teagues, the committee chair, immediately after the selection show. And one thing he said about how Xavier didn't get into the field was its record against against tournament teams. They went 5-13 against teams that are in the field. I suppose that's valid. But if we're going to play that same game, Oregon State didn't have an impressive record in the exact same category. And not only are they in the field, which they should have been, but they're a top eight national seed. And I think that there were a lot of better teams in terms of arguments to be a host potentially through supers than independent Oregon State. A couple numbers that really stood out to me in that argument, and granted, I recognize that the number 7 overall RPI is good, but 42 overall strength of schedule doesn't really move the needle for me. Non-conference strength of schedule, which would be an area that you'd think that they would really challenge themselves, given the fact that they aren't playing a conference, is 36th overall. And 11-11 in quad one wins is good. 9-0-1 in quad two, also very good. So the metrics are there. I'm not saying that it's a blasphemous decision to put them up top, but given the strength of schedule in an independent format and the fact that we have teams like a Coastal Carolina that are having a record-breaking season, they're two wins shy of their win total from when they won the national championship in 2016, I just have a hard time justifying that being the number eight. I think Oregon State was a lock to be a top 16, but Peter and I in our conversations over the last couple of weeks, and not to speak for Peter here, but I think we would both tell you that was a surprise and kind of a head scratcher.
I think furthermore, not to you know, beat a dead horse, but they had 6 wins against tournament teams. They're not in a conference, as you said. We touched on Coastal already. Clemson had the 9th best RPI. They played for an ACC championship game. Ole Miss was sitting there at 12. They played for an SEC title. And then even Oregon. Oregon went 4-0 against Oregon State and also played in a conference. So, I mean, the more we talk about it, the more kind of head-scratching that decision is to have them shove all the way up there at 8. They were a slam dunk to host. That was never a question. But, you know, I think it would have been much more reasonable if they had swapped them with Coastal or any of the teams that we had talked about behind them.
I'll just note with that East Carolina 2022, last time a non, a mid-major or a non-Power 4 conference team was a top 8 seed. So it has been a few years here now. Speaking of that, to kind of finish up on our national seed front, Southern Miss did get to, you know, that last national seed, 16th. Jacob, you know, like, this is a program that year in, year out is really kind of one of the rock solid programs in college baseball. But what is important about them getting that 16th seed?
You know, I do think it's important to go back to the conversation that we were just having, that they got the 16 seed, because it does show, you know, kind of a vote of confidence for the mid-major level, and that there is maybe not a path to a top 8 national seed, but if you do have a good season, you can host. And I think that that's valuable, and it's a glimmer of hope in a rapidly shifting college baseball landscape that's becoming more and more top heavy seemingly annually. So I think from that standpoint, it's good. But I'll be the bad guy here for Southern Miss. This was another head scratcher for me. I thought that there were other teams that were deserving of being in the top 16 before Southern Miss. And maybe this is where the, you know, inherent bias of how the committee is constructed comes into play, because they did have a program administrator on the committee. We've known for years that that ends up being a factor. I would even go as far as to say that Southeastern Louisiana being one of the last four or the first 4 teams out is a little bit crazy over a team like Xavier. And it points to the fact that, you know, you had somebody in the room who was able to kind of vouch for you.
Can I just add with that? And it was the perfect one, though. I'll say this for it. It's the perfect one for it in that if it wasn't the last team in, right? And that would be like an utter outrage. It's kind of throwing that little bit of like, okay, we're going to give you a cookie on your way out. You didn't make it. You weren't going to make it. But we'll alpha, you know, we'll put you as, you know, as one of the first 4 out, even though you probably aren't one of the first 4 out.
And I think that's a worse look if we're being completely honest here. I mean, there's no real consolation to being one of the first losers. Like, you didn't get into the field, so you might as well try and have your last 4 list or your first 4 list look something like a real first 4 out. And this doesn't to me. I think that there are several teams that have better resumes to have been close to the field like that than Southeastern Louisiana did. And it does very plainly point to bias on the committee. And I think that that absolutely played a factor in Southern Miss getting to the spot that it's in. Yes, Southern Miss has 44 total wins and 24 conference wins. That is impressive. But we are not even talking about a very strong Sun Belt this year. It's a 2-bid Sun Belt, and both of those teams being hosts is a little bit head-scratching. One other thing that I'll point to, no other team that's a host right now has a lower strength of schedule or a lower RPI than Southern Miss does. So I think that you look at an Alabama at number 13 in RPI and you wonder, well, if RPI was such a factor everywhere else, how did it not apply to an Alabama team that is 13th in RPI with 41 wins, 16 conference wins, the number 20 overall strength of schedule, and 20 quad 1 and quad 2 wins compared to Southern Miss's 13. Alabama, I think fittingly, is going to be in the regional with Southern Miss. So I have Southern Miss on upset watch. I think it's very fascinating that that regional will be in Hattiesburg over Tuscaloosa. I think it's important to continue to reiterate this. Do I think it's an egregious decision? No. And I really don't actually think that there's a single egregious decision across the landscape here. I do think it's a little puzzling, though.
I was going to segue to you on this, which is, that leads to kind of the next thing we wanted to talk about, which was there are a number of 2 seeds that we think have really good shots. That would seem to be one of them, would it not?
Yeah. So, I mean, heading into last night, really, until the hosts were announced, Southern Miss was either going to be that last host at number 16 or ranked number 1 or number 2 in terms of 2 seeds you wouldn't want to see. And I think on the hosting discussion, at least comparing apples to apples a little bit here, TCU and Southern Miss for that last hosting spot. And this isn't even bringing up Georgia Tech, who's the first ACC regular season champ to not host since 1999. So we're, for the sake of the debate here, we're leaving them out of it for now. But TCU versus Southern Miss, TCU 18th in RPI, Southern Miss 19. Okay, fine. They both made it to their respective conferences championship game and lost in said championship game, TCU in extra innings to Arizona. Southern Miss played really well against Coastal Carolina. So the Sun Belt is a quality league, but I think we can all agree that the Big 12 top to bottom is better than the Sun Belt. It's just deeper. Strength of schedule, TCU 18 to Southern Miss is 67. Non-conference strength of schedule, fairly comparable, I think. You know, TCU's was 14, Southern Miss's was 21, not a huge gap there. TCU has the edge in quad one wins. TCU has double the quad two wins, Q1 plus Q2. TCU has 20 to Southern Miss's 13. If the committee is going to say that the Big 12 is a good enough league to send eight teams to a regional, how is not one of them good enough to host? That's just kind of my argument there. And then obviously with Georgia Tech, we hit on it. First ACC regular season champ to not host since 1999. On top of its regular season title, they crossed the 40 win threshold, kind of a landmark, you know, across the sport. They earned 20 ACC victories, ACC semifinalist, and they had a dozen quad one wins. And instead of hosting, not only are they not hosting, they head to the number 10 overall seed. In Ole Miss, and the same can be said for TCU. Not only is TCU not hosting, they're going to the number 8 overall national seed in Oregon State. I mean, again, Southern Miss is a really good team. They're more than deserving of all the success they have. There's a compelling argument to host there. I mean, I'd probably power rank them third, though, behind TCU at 1 and Georgia Tech at 2 for the 16th spot.
Jacob, that's one of the things that kind of jumps out here, what Peter made the note of here. Like, oh, we talked about Alabama. Okay, Alabama is the 2 seed at the 16. So effectively, I know that geography plays a role here, but effectively they're saying, okay, Alabama, you were that close. The message also seems to be with that, though, is Georgia Tech and TCU, you really weren't that close to hosting. You're going to have a much harder path in some ways.
I would caution against that line of thought somewhat, because we do know that the committee doesn't necessarily play on that S curve where, you know, the best 2 seed gets to go to the 16 and the worst 2 seed goes to the 1. And that's not really actually how it ends up unfolding almost ever. Geography plays a factor. Where teams have played in previous regionals, who they've played in the regular season. You can't be in a regional with a team that's in your conference. So there are kind of a lot of factors at play. I'll also point out that with 13 SEC teams in the field this year, it makes it really hard to place SEC teams. So, there's a cascading effect to that. So, you know, when it becomes harder to place SEC teams, it becomes harder to place ACC teams and Big 12 teams. So, you know, I'm not as hellbent on where each 2 seed was as much as I am who was a 2 seed and who was a host. I agree with Peter that TCU, Bama were probably in the Georgia Tech were in the bucket of teams that I would have put in the, above the hosting line prior to Southern Miss. I'm not as stuck on where each team ended up. One thing that I will say though on this interesting 2 seeds talk, not to shift the conversation here, and I'm going to beat Peter to the punch, but Northeastern to me feels like a nightmare 2 seed to have inherited. That is the best pitching team in the country by ERA. They ride a 27-game win streak into the postseason. And according to multiple coaches who have played Northeastern this year, I've had one tell me that they think that they could play their way all the way to the national championship. He thinks that they're so good. So am I here predicting that? Not at all. I think that that's a very bold prediction. But I think it's very exciting, though, is what I would say. I think that Northeastern has a case to be a really strong 2 seed. I also look at Florida in that Conway regional, and I once again see a team that I would not want to host. You know, Florida last year was one of the last 4 teams into the field. They're a 3 seed in Stillwater. They run that regional very easily. They get through Clemson in 2 games, and they make Omaha for the second year in a row. Florida's just one of those teams that I don't think anybody wants to see in the postseason. Kevin O'Sullivan kind of has this reputation for however the regular season went, throw it out the window because we're going to kick butt in the postseason. So that's one that I really wouldn't want. Georgia Tech is another one. TCU being at Oregon State, I actually think is kind of a favor to TCU. I know that, you know, the question here was, is TCU, you know, kind of getting the short end of the stick by being put in a top eight national seed? Optically, yes, that's true. They should never have been in a top eight national seed. But we also just got through talking about how Oregon State isn't really battle tested. It's a very questionable top eight national seed. I actually like TCU's chances to get out of that regional. If I had to predict right now 1-2 seed to get into a super, I'd probably look at the Horned Frogs. I think that that's a really good regional for them. I don't think USC is much of a challenge. I don't think that their 4 seed is much of a threat either in St. Mary's. So if you're TCU, are you offended by the fact that you got put in a top eight national seed? Maybe. But if you actually look at the bracket and you start to break down the teams that are in it, I don't think that they're terribly upset by this.
Yeah, and I mean, you really hit on all the interesting and dangerous number two seeds. So I guess furthermore on TCU, I'm with you. You know, we can talk about their hosting snub and heading to a top eight national seed, at least optically. It also does set the stage potentially. Scratch that. I'm with you that I think they have a really solid chance to come out of this regional.
Hold on, if we're going to do that, just give me a pause so I can visually see it. So we'll wait.
I think with TCU, you know, in that regional, for as, again, optically as, you know, puzzling it is that they're going to a top eight national seed, I do think it's a solid matchup. They can really, really swing it. It's a team that's led by potential national freshman of the year, Sawyer Strohsnyder, and they have a bona fide horse on the mound that's gonna get the ball probably in game one. In Tommy Lepore, who's pitched his way to a 2.89 ERA with 83 Ks and 87 in a third inning. So they're a really, really talented club, but I think focusing a little more on Northeastern and giving them some love, and man, that the Tallahassee regional is, that's going to be an absolute war with Florida State hosting. You've Northeastern is the two and Mississippi State is the three. You know, no disrespect to Bethune-Cookman at the four, but man, that's a heck of a top three seed trio there. But Northeastern statistically is the best pitching team in the country, but it's not necessarily a one-trick pony with its pitching only. They have a pretty dynamic and powerful duo in its lineup with Harrison Feinberg, who took home Conference Player of the Year honors, and then also Cam Maldonado, who is a prominent draft prospect coming out of this summer after playing well in the Cape, but he's only boosted his stock this year at Northeastern. Great body with fun tools. And really, there is no weak link on the entire pitching staff, whether it's the rotation or the bullpen. There is not one arm, unless everything goes completely haywire, where they really got to dig deep into their pockets. There's not one arm on the pitching staff that you'll see this weekend that Coach Glavin and company feel iffy about. And I think that's a testament to what they've done in Brookline. And for my money's worth, Coach Glavin is probably the most underrated coach in America, just given how the game is changing with the transfer portal kind of becoming like almost a free agency period in the wild, wild west each summer. And obviously the prominence of NIL, they've remained steady and have kind of held court as one of the premier teams, if not the premier team in the region year after year. They go after veteran and older experienced guys in the portal. Sometimes from Division II or Division III schools. They do an excellent job at retaining their players year over year, specifically outfielders, Mike Sirota, who's now in the Dodgers system, and Cam Maldonado. Those are two guys who easily could have transferred to major, major programs, probably gotten a lot of money from major, major programs, yet they stayed at Northeastern. They developed. Cam Maldonado is going to go in a good spot this July. And they've brought a ton of success there. So I think a ton of credit goes to Coach Glavin. This has been an unbelievable season for the Huskies. They have the most wins in the country at 48. They enter the tournament, as Jacob said, the hottest team in America. It's hard to argue against that. They've won 27 straight games. I feel like they are a very popular Omaha sleeper team every season. I, again, wrote about them as such heading into this year. But this year really feels like, you know, this could be the year they finally break down that door and play for a College World Series.
Okay. I want to put y'all on the spot, though. We've done the twos. Are there any threes or fours that you look at here? It's probably threes, but are there any three or four seeds that you think have a plausible path? You know, like, again, we're asking, this is upset watch. a three gets out. It happens most every year, but if a three gets out, a four gets out, especially, that's a surprise. But if that's going to happen this weekend, I'll start with you, Jacob. Who would you say, okay, this is the team that could do it?
Yeah, there are three on the three line that really stand out to me right now, and maybe even four. I'll mention the one that I'm iffy on, and that's Nebraska. Nebraska's gotten hot lately, and so that always bodes well for teams when they're getting into the postseason. Do I think that that has, you know, real super regional potential? No, and I'll even preface the rest of this by saying I don't think that that's going to be the year that a three or a four seed, you know, advances. We're same as last year when we saw such a top-heavy college baseball. It's just so hard for these teams to advance. However, the three that stand out to me right now are Oklahoma State as a three seed. I think that Josh Holliday does a really good job. They're quietly one of the better pitching staffs in the country. And I'll point out very importantly, that is a team that can hit a ton of home runs, specifically Nolan Schubart, who we have evaluated to have 70 power and one of very few college bats this year that has clear 70 power. And he now gets to go and play in the shoebox that is Foley Field in Athens. And guess where his power is heading? It's right field. You know, the math tells us right now, the right launch angle on a neutral wind day in Athens, you can hit a ball out at about 93 miles per hour. It's statistically proven that that is the case. Well, Schubart likes to hit the ball a lot harder than 93 miles per hour in the air to the pole side. So I do think that that's kind of a ripe for upset regional. And I did post about that this morning. I think Duke kind of has the same case. AJ Gracia, Jake Hyde, their number two and three home run hitters are left-handed. So they're going to have ample opportunities to get the ball out in that field. I think that Stetson, and Pete and I talked about this last night in our final Field of 64 call, Stetson's had a great year, and they have some pieces on that roster that are a lot of fun. I think that they are a bolder pick to advance out of a regional, as are all of these three or four seeds. But if I had to go with one real sleeper, you know, that Auburn regional is tough, but do I think that Auburn has kind of that stumble potential? Yeah, I do. And I go back to what we thought about them in the preseason. We were really skeptical about what this Auburn team was going to be. It's young. It doesn't have a lot of postseason experience. A lot of the guys who are older on that roster who have been successful for them are transfers who are not a part of the program last year. I'm looking at like Samuel Dutton, their ace right-hander who's been excellent this season but has not really had a good year prior to this or contributed at a very high level on a postseason team. So I think Stetson maybe is one of those teams that could sneak out. And the last one for me is Western Kentucky. You know, we've been high at BA on Western Kentucky this year. We had them ranked at one point. No other publication had them ranked at the time. So we were the high guys on the Hilltoppers. Ryan Wideman, their center fielder, you know, you go put him in that Cam Maldonado, very toolsy, exciting draft prospect type bucket who can make some noise. And they throw the ball well. They're a very sound pitching staff that's been consistent all year this year. So I wouldn't rule out necessarily a Western Kentucky rise up through what is a very, very difficult Oxford regional with Mississippi State. I just said Mississippi State, Ole Miss, Georgia Tech, and Murray State.
What about you, Peter? Anyone that jumps out to you?
Yeah, so Jacob kind of picked my pocket a little bit with Oklahoma State.
You could just say I agree. You know, it's okay.
I definitely agree with Oklahoma State and Stetson, and I think furthermore, starting off 1-0 in these two and three games is another huge key for any three or even four seed that's going to want to pull off an upset and advance to a super. So I guess taking that into consideration, the Hattiesburg regional in and of itself is a really, really tough one where everyone kind of projects to be just beating up on each other. So in that breath of, you know, there being some degree of parity there, and then also winning game one, and Miami has a really, really tough matchup against Alabama, but giving the ball to Griffin Hugus in the first game, I think puts the Hurricanes in at least a decent position to play with the Crimson Tide, if not pull off an upset. We saw Miami, they're kind of dead in the water in the middle part of the season, and then they really, really turned it on for 15, 20 or so games and played itself into the tournament field. And on top of Hugus, Daniel Cuvée has been one of the hottest hitters in the country. He's sitting now 378 with 34 extra base hits, including 16 home runs and 76 RBIs. It's thunderous raw power, and you supplement him with the experience of Jake Ogden, who's been excellent atop Miami's lineup, hitting 350 with 19 extra base hits. And then they've got a handful of other pieces in that lineup who kind of make the whole operation go. So I'm with Jacob and Stetson. in Oklahoma State, especially with Stetson and NC State. Stetson almost certainly is going to give the ball to left-hander Jonathan Gonzalez in game one. He's an experienced little lefty strike thrower who's one of, if not the best pitchers in the Atlantic Sun this year. It's hard to argue that he wasn't the best pitcher in the A-Sun this year. Pitched his way to a 2.26 ERA with 101 Ks to 18 walks and just 87 and two-thirds innings. One of the best strike throwers in the country. He's going to put them in a position to win. It's just a matter of if they can hit enough to keep up with a pretty deep NC State offense. So I think those are two great picks. Miami, I kind of have on my radar a little bit. And then also East Carolina to a little bit of a lesser degree, but riding the hot hand. I think Florida is just going to be too much of a buzzsaw when all is said and done, though.
Okay. So now we still have, I thankfully, I'm talking to the experts here. I don't have to do this, but we're with picks to click. Congratulations, Jacob, on winning the first half. Congratulations, Peter, on winning the second half. So now we got the tiebreaker. We've got the postseason here. So we'll do this every week so that, you know, that keep it kind of going here a little bit. So I guess Peter gets first shot here. You know, so what? We do a hitter and a pitcher, right?
So if I actually could just jump in real quick.
Go ahead. Take it.
So during the regular season, the way that we ran picks to click was that we alternated week to week, one hitter, then one pitcher. For the postseason, Peter and I opted to kind of up the stakes a little bit, especially with the season tied, me taking the first half and him the second. And so we are going to go one pitcher, one hitter, and you can score 2 points a week. So previously you could score 1 point. Now, technically, we could split a week, which kind of adds an interesting wrinkle to this. But yes, one pitcher and one hitter. Actually, and I would also argue that we should go one and one. So we should go my hitter. Yeah.
Okay.
I'll start with my pitcher then. Just because I'm a little worried my pocket's going to get picked. And also knowing we're doing this on a weekly basis also changes who I would pick. So I'll save my mega dudes.
Right, because once you pick one, then that's gone for you can't, you know.
Done.
Exactly. So with that being said, and also a little bit to kind of go along with the theme of exciting three seeds, I'm going to take Oklahoma State left-hander Harrison Bodendorf. Funky lefty. Plus strike thrower with a plus changeup, has been the anchor atop Oklahoma State's rotation all season. Pitched his way to a 2.77 ERA with 100 Ks and 87 and two-thirds innings. If Oklahoma State's going to want to make it out of the Athens Regional and kind of go on a Cinderella run here, Bodendorf is going to need to be the tone setter and turn in a quality start like he's done consistently all season. So I think he's in for another one, and he's my pick on the mound this week.
I think Jacob agrees because I feel like that he just utterly got his pocket picked right there.
Oh, you are the worst. Well,
okay. So you can pick. No, by the way, you can pick hitter or pitcher. I'd say, like, you know, like this is your first pick.
Okay, I'm gonna trade my pitcher here just because I already have him in mind and I'm very disappointed. I'm gonna go with Jacob Morrison from Coastal Carolina, mostly hoping that he's gonna get the first game of the regional, which would be against the four seed with them hosting. So he would play Fairfield. He's just been outstanding this year. 0.87 whip, 1.9 ERA in over 80 innings. One of the most consistent Friday night guys in the country. Somebody who I think has actually kind of made a name for himself on the draft front. He's super tall, lanky right-hander. Good stuff overall and has gotten results this season. So I'm going to bank on the results continuing one more week. He hasn't faltered yet. And because Peter picked my pocket unbelievably with 64 pitchers, 64 teams you could have picked pitchers from, and you picked the one I wanted.
Not just 64 pitchers, yeah.
Yeah, there's hundreds of pitchers. There's hundreds of pitchers, and he picked the one I wanted. So I'm going with Jacob Morrison as my pitcher. Gosh,
you're interesting call on his part because he could have blocked a hitter from you. You're not taking another pitcher, but okay. So Peter.
I'm just confident I'm going to get my hitter here.
Actually, you know what? Jacob, you get to go again, so we'll snake draft this. That's fair.
Okay.
So you still get your first hitter.
I appreciate that. And I'm going to go back to the well on somebody that I talked about earlier because I'm going to play the ballpark factors. This is the Rudner model pick right here. I'm going with Nolan Schubart. I think that that ballpark is an absolute dream for a left-handed hitter like him. He's not exactly facing the best pitching. Only Oklahoma State has a top 50 ERA in that entire regional. Duke, we've seen, have some struggles on the mound. Georgia, we've talked about it extensively on the podcast, has been very inconsistent on the mound, though better lately. And so I look at a guy like Nolan Schubart, and I see that ballpark with the short porch in right field and the power that he has, and kind of the statement that needs to be made as far as the draft goes and kind of putting a bow on his final collegiate season and really asserting to the scouting community, I belong in the first round. Talk about a great opportunity to do that. Athens is a dream spot, like I said, for a guy like Schubart. So, you know, I hope I picked your pocket there, Peter, but I'm going with him.
Not as much as I picked yours, but my hitter, I'm kind of, because I, you know, if the regionals go as planned, you know, we'll probably have more of, I guess, prominent prospects to pick from as we get into supers in Omaha. So I'm trying to not go with like mega dudes here with my pick. So with my hitter, I'm going to take Brady Ballinger from Kansas. He's emerged as one of the better hitters in the Big 12 this year after transferring from JUCO Power, College of Southern Nevada. It's a really intriguing hit power combo. Led the Jayhawks this year and was, again, he anchored that lineup. He hit 363 with 21 doubles, 16 homers, 56 RBIs, and a walk to strikeout ratio of 56 to 43. Like I said, it's a well-rounded and impressive offensive profile. And then also digging a little bit further into the potential matchups this weekend, obviously Fayetteville is a very tall task, especially if they end up playing the Razorbacks once or twice this weekend. But in looking at other potential projected matchups in Creighton and North Dakota State, and you combine that with the fact that Ballinger has been a really high-level producer all season for the Jayhawks, I feel good about him having a solid weekend in Fayetteville.
So there we go. We have our picks to click. We have so much baseball this upcoming this weekend. It'll be just basically a torrent running over us all weekend. It'll be fun. We'll see. We hope that this is kind of our first taste of it. We'll be continuing to cover, obviously, the tournament all the way through. For Jacob, for Peter, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.